Azbegut Oli, and welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That, by the way, is Catalan for "you have drunk oil."
Jeez, I hope you haven't. Oh, I haven't.
Well, it's an idiom, Danny, for that you've messed something up.
Yeah, I guess drinking oil would be considered a pretty big mess up.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it refers to like olive oil or motor oil, but I did like the car oil connection.
Yeah, that works.
A couple mess ups in this race, which we'll get into. That's Danny O'Dwyer. I'm Drew Scanlon. How are you, Danny?
I'm good. That race was boring, but we're gonna make it entertaining. That's our job. That's why
it's a strategy race, Danny.
That's true.
Find and replace boring.
That's true. I did fall asleep for 20 laps in the middle, literally, but that's mostly because it was a 6 a.m. race as well.
Did you ever play America's Army?
Yes, the American military developed video game entertainment property. Yes, I did play.
They had a chat filter in the game where if you typed camping, like that guy is camping, it would replace it to that guy is using tactics.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah.
Wow, censorship by the US Army. Unbelievable. Also, wasn't that the game where if you both played the army, you were like the other
side always looked like generic terrorists.
Terrorists, yes. Yeah. Great. Dehumanizing. Love it.
Good anyway. Stuff. Also joining us, Rob Zachney. How are you, Rob?
Not bad. The bridge level in America's Army is pretty good. Like it had one banger shooter level, not gonna lie.
My favorite map was Insurgent Camp, and the filter even filtered that out, so it's like, oh, my favorite map is Insurgent Use Tactics.
Wow.
You were kidding me.
Yes.
Oh my god. Wow. We don't deserve video games. They're so good.
If you're new to this podcast, welcome. And if you are new to Formula One itself, we've got an episode just for you. Our preseason primer episode assumes no prior F1 knowledge and explains how the sport works and who everybody is. So if you'd like to go back and listen to that and get caught up on everything, that's episode 137. Also, the show is supported entirely by our audience over at patreon.com/shiftf1, where every month we release bonus podcasts and videos exclusively for our patrons. You can also hop into the patron-only Discord. But those bonus podcasts and stuff cover racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, experiments with other racing series, and a lot of weird things. So if you'd like to support the show and get access to all of that fun stuff, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click the link in the show notes. What's going on this month, Danny?
Yeah, we had the Spain track walk went up where I drove around Barcelona. I keep saying it wrong. Barcelona, Catalunya. In my driving setup with my wheel and everything set up at home. I did accidentally post this to all patrons. So a lot of people got to have a taste of the wonderful track walk meals we've been setting up, and we got a couple of extra Media Pass patrons out of that. So I guess thanks everyone. We will continue to do those. We'll have a podcast later this month for Drive to Survive, the third episode. And also I am going to be recording my card pack opening Monaco. So once
you're
we're done with the casinos, we will we'll get to it. I'm just saying card pack though. I'm not advertising the specific company that is doing it. Massive thanks, of course, to all of our incredible title sponsors: Will Romph, Reagan, Jason Kelly, Jason Chadwick, Umberto Roca, Bailey Foot, Abdullah Althani, Sam G, Greg Salt, Circuit Demon, Oh Yes Food, PS, congrats on the new house, Drew Stewart, Jack Venn, Connor McManners, and of course, BPM, which stands for, I figured it out, Big Promble Motorsports.
Big Promble.
Big Promble.
What up, Big Promble? Awesome.
BPM. Oh.
Oh, the BPM. The Brombles per minute. Today... The Spanish Grand Prix, everyone. What do we say? We hop right into the starting lineup.
Let's do it.
Leading off, I don't know why I'm speaking baseball here. Lewis Hamilton, 100th pole position.
It's a lot.
That's a lot of pole positions.
Yeah.
Behind him, Max Verstappen in second, and then Valtteri Bottas in third. Familiar top three.
Hamverbot.
Charles Leclerc in fourth place, however. Yeah. Starting fourth on the grid, second row. Esteban Ocon in fifth could potentially have been even higher, apparently, but for an engine misfire on the final qualifying lap.
Wow.
Carlos Sainz, the other Ferrari, in sixth place. Daniel Ricciardo in seventh. Sergio Perez in eighth. Apparently, he was hampered by a shoulder problem in qualifying.
He was straight up, he was like sick. It seemed like he was just very weak. Was it a shoulder issue? It was in the end.
Yeah.
Interesting.
He spun on his first run in Q3, leaving it all for the second run, but he ended up in eighth. Just behind him, Lando Norris, he was held up by Mazepin in qualifying one, which earned Mazepin a penalty.
Mazepin spinning is the last year's is the old meme. The new meme is Mazepin getting blue flags and blocking people.
Yeah. Fernando Alonso, 10th place behind him. Stroll, Gasly, Vettel, who also has the aero upgrades this time. Antonio Giovinazzi, George Russell in 15th. Another Q2 appearance for Georgie boy. Way to go, George. Yuki Tsunoda in 16th. Kimi Raikkonen in 17th. He got a puncture in free practice 3 after he ran over one of the embedded cameras in the curb.
Oh, wow.
Which was wild. Never seen that before. 18th was Mick Schumacher, 19th Nicholas Latifi, and 20th Nikita Mazepin. He qualified 20th and then got a 3-place grid penalty. So
23rd.
Yeah.
Paint in some new boxes.
He also ended up in the gravel twice in the first 10 minutes of free practice 1.
Get it out of the way, man. Just like flush it out of your system. Just
the commentators even thought they were seeing a replay again when they showed the second one. They were, oh, nope, that's a new one.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Tsunoda, though, in 16th, had some choice words after the fact. Rob, I think you you pointed this out.
Well, I mean, yeah, he basically he had a... They do that interview for people who get knocked out in Q1, and he said some things that seemed like he was arguing that the team was setting up the car differently, and like that Gasly has a better car than he does. And the awkward thing for me in all this is, like, he apologized for his outburst, and I think Jensen Button was on the broadcast saying that, like, you know, you can't really do that. You can't really speak that way. Certainly not at a France-tossed run team. And all of that is true, but at the same time, the dude is a native Japanese speaker with a lot of classic English as second language issues. And so, to an extent, like, the degree to which he's kind of being subjected to the same, like, language parsing as other F1 drivers is bugging me. I heard that interview. I thought it was ambiguous what he was even saying, because it also seemed like he was talking about, like, Gasly's setup is the opposite. And everyone is like, he can't say that. And I'm like, it also sounds like he might be talking about different, like, handling results, like that there might be some real inconsistencies with what is being reported across the team. I don't exactly know what he was driving at. He apologized, and he clearly does sort of rage out in the car and blow up. Like, that's not great. But it was a little bit not just unfair. I am really skeptical that people properly understood what he was driving at, and I'd be really curious, like, to see what he would say in a Japanese language outlet that is translated, you know, back in English. Because I am just not really confident that the way he's coming across in English actually tells us much about how he regards the situation in the team.
Yeah, I'm with Rob on this. I think I think it doesn't help that he's such a fiery character on team radio that then people are like inferring that he's impatient or difficult or stuff like that. You know, I don't necessarily. It's like sports. It's like when people shout on a soccer pitch or something. It's not the same as when they come off, right? And I'm kind of less, you know, concerned about that, but I do think there is a lot of the way in which we love to read into the minutiae of what people say, you know. And obviously, you know, go back 10 years and look at F1 interviews. Look, they didn't do as many interviews. They weren't as good at the interviews. The post-race interviews were always really awkward and weird, whereas now everyone is so savvy. Like, you can talk to like Nicholas Latifi and he's able to give like a punchy answer. Like, it's part of the gig, and we're sort of laboring hit Sonoda with that expectation with like a really tricky language transition. I think certain mountains being made out of molehills a little bit with regards to this. Considering what happened in the race, now the whole thing is actually quite funny.
Well, yeah. do you guys think, I this may just be me, but I detect a little bit of a like a tone of when people talk about Yuki sometimes, it's like he should be grateful that he has a spot because he's a rookie, and so he's not entitled to have complaints about stuff. Do you guys feel that at all?
There was definitely... So I think with Button in particular, it was a, that's not how things are done. I think part of it is that, is like, there is a sense of this is what professionalism looks like in F1. And I did feel like with that remark that like, well, he's, you know, he's part of a good team. Franz Tost runs a good team. I don't know. There are elements of like, yeah, he's a rookie. He was, you know, promoted. It does feel like the dynamics around him are weird. I don't love them. And I think it's one of those things where this could end up affecting his career because like it's a narrative that's kind of being built around this guy four races in. And I think that narrative is partly based on just some weird interpretations of what's going on and some admittedly awkward results out on track. But these, you know, he's not the first driver to have these struggles.
Yeah. And like in a 20, whatever, how many races is it? 23 races still this year?
Yeah.
Yeah. In a season like that, like if he gets a couple of good results or like, you know, fine results under his belt, a lot of this stuff will be lost in the wash, you know what I mean? Like we're early in the season, but I do agree with Rob that like it is difficult to shake a first impression, and you know, he's lucky Mazepin is around a little bit, because I think maybe he'd have a unfairly I think maybe he'd have a bit more negative attention if that wasn't the case. But he's a good driver, and you know, I hopefully, you know, he'll marry with that car. We have talked a lot about the fact that he is not the only driver who's having trouble with their new car. It's just part of the thing.
This actually does remind me, I don't know if we talked about this, but when Montoya was giving an interview a few weeks ago, just being asked about the state of the sport, one of the remarks he made was that in his day, teams worked with drivers to set up the car. And
yes, we talked
now,
about this a couple of weeks back, didn't we?
Now the mode is very much, we set up our car the way we like, and your job is to learn to drive it. And Montoya, who was a good driver, like unimpeachable source here, it was basically saying like, it's way trickier now because like people have different driving styles, and you used to have a situation where you could like tailor your ride a little bit to your style. And now it's very much the driver's being treated as this like interchangeable part. And so to a degree, like there might, the other thing that might be being underestimated here is that Tsunoda might be driving a car that is uniquely difficult for him. And it might be the case that like Toro Rosso isn't like making those adaptations because the thing is defined by Gasly and running in his style and his pace. So I think that's the other thing I would point out, is this might be a harder sport to transition into than it used to be. And with some of those veteran drivers having their own issues, might be harder to transition.
Yeah, like Ricciardo's having the same problem in the McLaren. Perez is having the same problem in the Rebel, where they're having to like relearn everything. I totally see it. And also, like, look at Gasly. Like, Gasly's been at that team for a long time. I know he had his little sojourn with Red Bull, but like, you know, he's been in that garage for a long period of time. And also, what was interesting, we'll talk about it later, but like, you know, after this race and in other races recently, Hamilton has talked a lot about how much work he's done with the team on the car. Like, he's not that driver who gets the car handed to him. He's in there, you know what I mean? So yeah, definitely a salient point by Rob.
Well, let's take it to the race, everybody. Dan, you want to take us through the start?
Sure. A lot of talk this week about the right side of the grid. It comes up fairly often, the idea that the other side, Hamilton was on
the left, I think.
Left side, yeah, you're right. So that there's more rubber basically on the driving side of the track as opposed to the inside lane on the start-finish straight, where you tend not to have as many cars going on it, especially this weekend because we had not one, not two, but three Formula 3 races racing, before the race, the Formula One race on Sunday. So there was a lot of action going on. There was a lot of qualifying. There was a lot of cars on the track. So a lot of concerns from Hamilton that Vettel might have a better start because there is more rubber on the ground there, which means there's more grip. Sorry, Verstappen. You're right. So off they got. And that appeared to be the case, not just for Verstappen, but also for Charles Leclerc behind him. Decent little battle into that first turn. Hamilton wisely got out of the way of Verstappen into that right-hander from turn one leading into turn two, which made him lose a bit of time on Verstappen, but ultimately saved his race, perhaps, because looked like there would have been front contact with Hamilton, rear contact with Verstappen, which often does more damage to a front wing than it does a tire, or a bit of both, maybe. But then behind him also, interestingly, Bottas got nabbed by Charles Leclerc, who managed to get up the inside of him. And aside from that, there was a little bit of battling around in the back of the pack. A couple of drivers moved up decent spots, but surprisingly little contact, considering how many rookies we have and how cool the track temps were. I think by this stage, sounded like rain was probably not going to happen. Is that right?
Yeah, I think there were little drops before the race started, but once it did, it cleared right up.
I'll just say this. So, like, Leclerc making that pass basically blew up Bottas' race right from the start. And I think one thing that emerged real fast is that Catalunya remains a terrible track for overtaking. It was clear Valtteri had the pace on Leclerc, or should have, but, and this becomes a relevant thing later, that's sector three. You cannot keep it within DRS range when you cross the detection zone. And so you come onto the straight and you're never in DRS striking distance and you never get the toe. And that's the only place effectively that you can execute this move. I know we saw some action around like turn four, but like really this was a, you need that turn one, you need that main straight to turn one run to pull this off. And the circuit is really well tuned to prevent that from happening unless there's some major like differences between car performance. And so like watching Bottas fall away, it was like, oh shit, Catalunya's still bad.
It was interesting because turn 10, I was wondering, hypothesizing last week, whether or not that would give us a bit more overtaking because the cars can drive around that. It definitely did in F1. It did in F3. So the relative speed difference there's more overtaking in F3 anyway. There's like twice as many cars and they're not going as fast. But 10 was definitely an option. But I do wonder if the increased speed through 10, the lack of that hard braking zone that we used to have, actually made it even harder to close that gap in the third sector, because there was less of those small little turns where everyone's going
faster
slower.
Corner means more aero dependence, right? Like that's generally the rule. And so if you want like that was probably going to make it harder. I think Norris was saying this before the race, is like, hey, y'all shouldn't expect turn 10 to do anything good for overtaking. I also noticed that after this race, once again, they're like, you know, we're not sure about that final chicane in sector three. And I'm like, no, you shouldn't, because it sucks. Like, yeah. Catalunya has that beautiful outside corner that flows in this loop out to the main straight. And that's real good. That's a, you know, it's like this long radius turn. And instead in sector three, I feel like where people were losing the time, turn 10 may have been one issue. But then the way you got to check up to make that really hard chicane in sector three feels like that was the final like nail in the coffin of any sort of main straight turn one overtakes. And it sucked. Didn't like it. And I don't know, my notes, the next thing that really kind of happened was the Tsunoda thing.
Yeah. So he lap eight, his engine just stops. And something similar happened in free practice too, after he went over a curb. And then, you know, he was talking after qualifying about his car's not great, and here it stopped working. So this brings out a safety car, which has a lot of strategy implications, because it's going to allow a lot of the cars to switch onto the soft tire. It'll allow a lot of the cars who are on the soft tire to go much longer before pitting, which potentially will enable teams to switch strategy from a two stop to a one stop. It also allows cars to pit and not lose as much time as they would if everyone else was still going full speed on track. Giovinazzi opted to come in, but had a disastrous stop, something I've never seen or even heard about before. The medium tires are about to go on when a pit crew member holds up his arms in an X and then pounds on the tire with his fist, apparently indicating that the new tire was itself flat.
Well, you can see it, it flexes. Like, it's slack when he does it. Like, it's like a drum surface where there's just a huge amount of flexion when he bangs on it. I've never seen it in my life. I've never seen a new tire come out and be busted like that. And it wasn't obvious. Like, you did need to sort of squeeze it and put pressure down to realize the PSI.
Because it's
got to
be as heavy as it is.
The Alfa Romeo head of track engineering, Zevi Pujalar, in this quote from Autosport, says that the tire was all right when they checked it before the start of the race, and they have a bunch of monitoring stuff. His quote here says, it was an operational problem when just picking up the set at one point when getting everything ready in the garage that damaged the valve. We've got a monitoring system. It was okay when the race started, but at some point in the garage, then it went wrong a couple laps before the pit stop. So I guess moving it around, you know, the valve got stuck on something or somehow was damaged that caused the tire to deflate.
Because you're like, how else does a tire that big deflate that quickly? Operationally, a mess up, but in terms of their operation during the pit stop, like, everything's working great because they found the problem and rectified it. Like, it would have been, you know, and they did it relatively fast. Like, they knew what to do. It seemed like with this thing that has basically never happened before, maybe in F1, they actually like cleaned it up pretty quickly, which is cool.
Yeah. So due to the regulations that state that the tires have to be a part of a set, that meant that the other three tires also had to be swapped out. So the team had to run back into the garage and get them, resulting in about a 40-second stop for Giovinazzi.
I do sometimes wonder about the set rule. Like, I understand keeping the sets apart from drivers, keeping them separate that way. But, like, if you have your own set of, like, mediums out there that's in there, I sometimes wonder whether or not it's not overly harsh that you have to keep them together as a unified set if they've got the same wear. Like, I don't know.
I bet there's some reason, like there's some tactic some team would pull off that we didn't think of, like they'll swap the rears and the fronts, or they'll, you know, they'll do something weird with it. But I do wonder why that is. I wonder what they did with the other ones then. Did they keep them, or did they, you know, auction them off?
I expect that it has something to do with the way that you have to hand back the sets to Pirelli for analysis.
Oh, maybe.
After the race?
Yeah.
I don't know. Williams opted for a double stack pit stop here, which are always fun, setting them up for a one-stop race. And I guess just to summarize Russell's race here, he was running in 10th place at one point, but eventually those tires fell off and he drifted outside the points, which is kind of a bummer. Still, though, he said after the race, in this quote from Autosport, quote, "The car felt today the best it has ever felt in a race, and probably the best I can remember. That is what makes it so joyous to drive compared to normal. Most of which I put down to a calm day. We know the beast we have."
Does he mean it's not windy?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, there was a point where the wind kicked up and he was like, oh boy, it feels like it's getting windy.
You're right. It was like, it's like something out of a, like an anime or something. It's like his kryptonite. You know, it's like, oh no, here comes the wind. Yeah. I love it.
It wasn't
wind
even
watch.
That bad. Also, it was like 3 kilometer an hour breeze. And he was like, oh, here, oh shit, here we go again.
Here we go again. Spinning all over the place. The other, in terms of team radio, we also got the interesting Toto Wolff calling Michael Massey.
Was that this? That's much later.
Is it much later? Oh, really?
Yeah, lap 26.
Oh, wow.
We restart on lap 11. Verstappen gets away pretty well, keeping ahead of Hamilton.
But he he was way ahead of Hamilton by the time safety car, like 8 or 9 seconds, was it?
By the time what?
The safety car happened, he lost he had a massive advantage when the safety car happened because of Tsunoda. Yeah, he lost all that, but he had accrued a bigger gap, I think, that we saw between first and second for the entire race, aside from pit stops.
Yeah. Back in the pack, Stroll is hounding Fernando Alonso, trying to get by on the outside of turn 4 for 10th place. They pull even in the end, which gives Stroll the inside advantage on turn 5, and he takes the position. Gasly lap 19 has to serve a 5-second penalty for being out of position at the start.
Yeah.
You can see it pretty clearly from the replay. Like, his front tires are completely over the white line. And they pointed this out on the radio or on the broadcast. When you look from the top at a grid spot, there's the white box basically that your car has to be in, but there's also, you know, maybe 15% of the way down that box is a white or a yellow line that sticks out to the right. And that's so the driver, because the driver can't see the white box, but he can see that yellow line. And I don't know if he wasn't looking or what. He said after the race, "I'm sorry for the penalty. I thought I was fine, but that's just very silly." He also got a penalty point on his license for that.
Killer.
Around this time, Hamilton reports that his tires are starting to go, which is it's just a cliche at this point. And on lap 25, Verstappen pits from the lead to prevent Hamilton from undercutting him. So he's afraid that Hamilton will stop from behind him, put on new tires, and then lap much faster, so that when Verstappen pulls in and comes back out, Hamilton will be ahead. But it is a slow stop for Verstappen at 4.2 seconds, which the commentators surmised that maybe because it was a late decision. And in fact, it was a very late decision. Christian Horner, the team principal for Red Bull, says in this quote from Autosport, he called himself in. So we were not expecting him, which is why the pits weren't ready. And that's why the stop was a second longer. But jokes on them. Hamilton's tires actually are not that bad. I think a short while he says, tires are okay. It's all good.
Yeah, there was a lot of team radio stuff going on, because also Hamilton didn't seem to... when they called him in, it kind of flew under the radar as well. Like, they didn't say box. They maybe used a code word or something.
Yeah, maybe. Well, but this is when we get that lap 26 message to race control.
This is where the race gets interesting. Like, what interest there is in the race, I think this is where it comes in, because it feels like Mercedes had the idea that they wanted to reply within a lap and make up the pace on that lap as Verstappen's coming out and Hamilton is theoretically near the end of the stint, and he gets checked up a bit by Mazepin, and that's where you get Toto on the radio to Massey being like, "Mikey, he's going to cost us the position. You got to do something about this guy." And I think at that point they go on to a what seems like a riskier strategy. Once it was clear he wasn't going to get the time on that lap. Yeah, his tires were better, but they did sort of have to accept that they were going to lose the position when they did bring Hamilton in. And not just lose it, but like lose it by a pretty wide margin. He was going to fall pretty far astern of Verstappen. The question is whether that's going to matter. Because the thing we hadn't seen is both these cars running at race pace on the mediums. And boy howdy, once we got a taste of that, like, Horner called it immediately. Like, once that pit stop carried out on like 29, lap 29, I think Horner called it immediately, where he's like, "Oh, this is gonna be a repeat of Hungary." It was either this stop or the next one where Hamilton rotated in got a fresh clip for his attack on Verstappen, but like Horner kind of knew what the play was going to be. It was going to be they were going to use their pace advantage on the harder tires and their ability to like get more life out of them, and Verstappen was never in a position where he could reply, and so there wasn't. It was exciting.
There was the race pace issue, and then I don't want to jump the gun a bit, but there's also the track position issue when it comes to the second driver, which, and in a track in which overtaking is a nightmare, they really did not want to get stuck behind Bottas. And you did not have Perez in the mix to hold him up or create a pocket or force him to pit by doing an undercut, threatening Bottas's position. Leclerc was the one that was in the middle there. So it just, it was like a slow motion car crash, I bet, for Red Bull, because you know, strategy wise, it wasn't great. But also, even with Captain Hindsight, there's not really much I don't think they could have done.
So what Mercedes does do is like you said, Rob, lap 29, they pit Hamilton for medium tires, which will be four laps newer than Verstappen's and may give him the advantage toward the end of the race. But, you know, Mercedes doesn't think that the medium tire is going to last that long, I guess, and pits Hamilton again on lap 42.
Well, I think in some ways it was also an issue of they didn't anticipate how commanding the pace advantage was going to be. Like,
yeah, because Hamilton comes back out, he's 22 seconds behind Verstappen after doing that second stop with 22 laps to go.
Yeah, and on the team radio, they say he'll catch you by the last lap, which was not the case. He caught Verstappen with like six laps left.
Yeah, so with that first tire change, like the theory was, well, this is going to all happen at the end of the race. And instead, Hamilton just hoovered up the distance. And again, like, why this circuit is a problem. Hamilton had all the pace in the world on this first set of mediums, and he still couldn't do it. Like, you watched him try to pull into DRS range, and like sector three got him every time. And even once he did close up, there wasn't enough space with the toe to close the deal. And so he basically, like, at that point, they went to a different plan, which was, we will just pit the car again and eat this distance up again and do it in the last lap. So, like, that was the part where I felt like this was the thing that was not expected, was that the pace wasn't comparable on the mediums, that like the Mercedes completely had it to the point where they had an entire extra pit stop and change to get this done. And I think Verstappen couldn't reply, because if he tried to get fresh tires on, Hamilton probably would have just driven off into the distance on that set and gone to the end.
Yeah. A couple things here before we get to Hamilton charging up the field. Perez on lap 46 takes a huge lunge down the outside of turn one on Ricardo and taking fifth place, and makes it look easy. Shortly later, lap 50, Sainz also gets by McLaren in this spot. This time it's Norris for eighth place. Norris defended pretty late here, but Sainz's reflexes prevented any contact. Norris was shown a black and white flag for this.
Oh, he was.
It was a warning from race control for unsporting conduct. He was apologetic after the race, saying, in this quote from race fans, I was going to defend from Carlos, and I moved over, and then I moved again slightly, which you're really not allowed to do. So I didn't mean to do anything aggressive. I knew he was coming past, so that was just the way it is, but I didn't mean anything. I got to imagine instinct takes over in a lot of these situations.
Yeah, and Sainz was closing fast, so I wonder if he didn't even expect him to come as fast as he did.
Maybe.
It made it look worse.
Ricardo,
maybe.
Was also warned for weaving on the straight, which
really
you don't hear very often either.
They had him. Like, the replay they showed was pretty bad.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't a good moment.
No. Not a good moment for Valtteri Bottas. Lap 52. Danny, you want to take this one?
What? I'm trying to remember. I can't even remember.
Well, this is when he's told a couple times not to hold Hamilton up.
Yeah, you're in different strategy.
So this is interesting. Because after the fact, they're on different strategies. Clearly, they're on different strategies. Clearly, obviously, Hamilton's had an extra pit. He's flying up the pack. He's chasing Verstappen. It is an annoying circus to overtake on, even to close that gap, as Rob was saying. So, like, you're gonna need Bottas to basically take his foot off the pedal and let him pass, and he doesn't do it, and we're like, oh, here we go, it's the Silver War again. They're fighting in Spain. Remember when this happened at Rosberg and they had that really nasty crash on the first turn? It's like, we associate this track with a little bit of that in inter-team fighting at Mercedes. Apparently, according to Bottas after the race, he didn't get the message. So he thought they were racing for position. So I'm not sure if that holds water or if that's...
Well, that's him. Weird, because he said something where he was like, I was doing my own race and I was concerned about losing pace to Leclerc. And so he said he was like worried about handing the position over because also he was worried he was going to lose too much time. So there were some weird miscommunications, because the other thing is Hamilton, after the race, was like, I didn't know Valtteri had been told to pull off. He was like, I thought we were racing for position, and it was fine. I have no problems with Valtteri. So Hamilton didn't notice, really, that Valtteri was interfering with his race and not on script. And it didn't matter, because he waxed him pretty easily. He definitely cost him time, but it didn't turn out to be much of a speed bump for Hamilton. And I think it was just one of those things. I think it portends interesting things for Valtteri's relationship to the pit wall and to the team for the rest of the season.
I have a quote here from Toto Wolff from Race Fans. He says, quote, I can relate to Valtteri that he had a tough day again and you're annoyed. If we would have lost the race, it would be more critical. But in the end, it's something we can learn from. And it goes both directions. And this is what we will be discussing, but in a very camaraderie-like way.
Did he do it on 10? Was it turn 10, I think, he eventually got past?
Yes.
Into that, yeah. So there you go. Maybe if your teammate moves over, you can overtake on turn 10. I wonder if I misinterpreted that line of, I didn't know there was a message, as Hamilton and not Bottas then.
It could be.
That makes a bit more sense.
That didn't really seem to slow down Hamilton too much, because he closes the 11-second gap to Verstappen in 7 laps.
Woof.
And overtakes him on the outside of turn 1 with DRS.
Yeah.
Not even a problem. Around this time, both Alpines are coming under fire. Ocon from Norris, and a big train behind Alonso, who's in 10th.
Yeah.
Alonso did report an engine issue on lap 30.
They were also pretty optimistic with the one-stop strategy they put him on. Like, I think this was kind of the chickens coming home to roost on his tire wear.
Yeah, so it's Alonso, Stroll, Raikkonen, Gasly, and Vettel. Lap 61 saw Stroll attempt to move on Alonso, but Alonso pushes him wide, causing Stroll to go off track. Stroll then rejoin incorrectly. There's a cone, all right, bollard, that you are supposed to go on a certain, the left side of, and he went on the right.
Grosjean bollard.
Yeah. He was eventually cleared for this, though. The stewards, I guess, determining that he did make an effort, but he, sometimes they say, try to make it, but if you are going to, do some dangerous move to get there, don't worry about it.
If you're forced off the track as well, I think, is part of it, because then you have less time to make the move.
Yeah, Alonso also escaped a penalty for pushing Stroll wide for similar reasons. They determined that he did try to, he didn't do it on purpose. He did try to turn his car. Both of them were cleared for that. I think Stroll did end up getting ahead, but gave the place back. Lap 62, Norris gets by Ocon easily with DRS for 8th place. And then further behind Alonso, Gasly gets by Raikkonen through 10's turn and 11 into 12th. And then Stroll finally does get by Alonso at turn 1 for 10th, followed by Gasly around the outside of turn 4. And then one lap later, Gasly goes for the pass on Stroll on the start-finish straight, and Stroll also moves way late, and Gasly has to dodge at the last second, similar to the Norris move earlier. But
yeah, kind of remarkable we didn't have any contact in this race, especially if you watched any of the F3 races. Which had a lot of, especially on that first two turns, there was multiple leader to second car contacts in one race with different leaders and different second cars. Go check out the YouTube channel for Formula One if you want to check out little highlight packages of F3. The second race is bananas. Also, it's got a Schumacher and a Fittipaldi racing each other, which is something you don't see very often. That's David, Ralph's son.
There did end up being gaps for Bottas and Verstappen to pit and put on new tires to try for fastest laps, and Verstappen came out on top on that one. Hamilton cruised to another victory. He has won, I think, 5 in a row in Spain.
His best ever start to a season as well. This year. Yeah, I know. Our preseason primer, all the chat about for whatever reason, I don't know what's happening. The mid-pack is entertaining, but we're getting a lot of hamver bots, man.
Yeah, agreed. I feel like it's coming.
Yeah, me too.
But I also felt like I think I predicted last year at the start that like points for Williams are coming, and it always felt like maybe, and it never got there. So I hope this is not
if the next race isn't a bit of a cluster, then we have a lot of
Danny,
rookies.
The next race is Monaco.
Just think about Mazepin. Just think about like
he could like Austin Powers it somewhere in there.
That's true. Like we need, yeah, exactly, something like that. Also, yeah, wasn't it weird that we also had Formula E in Monaco this past weekend? There was a lot of racing this weekend. A lot of racing.
Yeah, but the result of the Spanish Grand Prix of 2021: Lewis Hamilton on top, Max Verstappen in second, and Valtteri Bottas in third, holding on to fourth place. Charles Leclerc, way to go, Chuck! And then Sergio Perez made his way up to fifth. Danny Ric in sixth, Carlos Sainz in seventh, Lando Norris in eighth. McLaren, the only team to score double points in every race so far. Esteban Ocon in ninth, Pierre Gasly in tenth, the final points paying position. And behind him, Stroll, Raikkonen, Vettel, Russell in 14th, followed by Giovinazzi, Latifi, Alonso. Latifi almost lost it on the penultimate corner. Prompting Alonso to say something over the radio like the Williams is going off track just for fun or something. Alonso in 17th, Mick Schumacher 18th, Nikita Mazepin 19th, and not classified was Yuki Tsunoda after that DNF for his engine. And Verstappen with the additional point for fastest lap. Driver standings, that leaves us with Lewis Hamilton on top with 94 points, Max Verstappen's in second with 80, Valtteri Bottas third with 47. Lando Norris has 41 and Charles Leclerc with 40. That's close. Sergio Perez is in sixth with 32. Danny Ric has 24. Sainz with 20. Esteban Ocon with 10. Pierre Gasly in 10th place with 8 points. Lance Stroll's got 5. So does Fernando Alonso. Yuki Tsunoda has 2. And then we've got Raikkonen, Giovinazzi, Vettel, Russell, Schumacher, Latifi, and Mazepin with 0.
Oh boy. It's official now, is it?
That's how it's listed on the website. Constructor standings, Mercedes is on top with 141. Red Bull's got 112. McLaren, again, with those double points, they're in a solid third with 65. Ferrari, though, is closing in fourth place with 60. Alpine has 15. There's the gap. AlphaTauri has 10. Aston Martin with 5, Alfa Romeo and Williams and Haas all have 0. And that's the race.
That's it,
everybody. Should we take it to the news?
Let's do it.
Let's talk about drivers, Rob.
Yeah, the silly season kind of revolves around Mercedes this year, or at least so far. And one of the big question marks was, does Hamilton want to continue in the sport? Well, that's been answered. Hamilton said this week that he wants a new contract with Mercedes before the summer break. He said, wow. We never want to be in the position that we were in January and February. It ruined my whole winter, and I'm sure it wasn't helpful for Toto in terms of being to be off and relaxed. So it felt like we didn't really have much of a break. These deals are very complex. It's never a super simple procedure. And so hopefully soon we can start, as long as it doesn't interfere with the actual job. We have 19 races to do, but it would be great to get something in place before the break. And then we could have a clear picture of the future. So my guess is that means Hamilton's going to get that deal. I don't see them like failing to sign Hamilton. I don't think they're in any, like, there's no upshot to Jerry Krausing the situation and like blowing up a winning combination. But the question is, does that combination, like that exact combination, stay with Hamilton, Bottas, and all of them being under Mercedes? Because Mercedes has two drivers that they basically have some options on at the end of this year. Russell is a free agent once his Williams deal wraps up. And I think that might be up this year. And so with Bottas on a one-year deal that expires at the end of this year, if they wanted to make a switch, this would be a moment to do that. Meanwhile, Ocon also has his option ending. Now, he has a, he is a Mercedes driver, but he has a deal with Renault where, and it's, Wolf basically poured cold water on this. He's like, Ocon has to work things out with Alpine. It really, he is a works driver for Alpine now. It comes down to where they are with that relationship. He's been doing okay over at Alpine. So I think the vibe is, I think Ocon's probably out of contention for that Mercedes spot. That sort of seemed like, you know, Wolf being like, it is on Ocon now to make a go of it at Alpine. Russell becomes the interesting one. Because one, I think Hamilton genuinely likes him. And two, I think it's hard not to look at Bottas's kind of lackluster performances in the car and not wonder like what Russell could be getting out of them.
Especially considering the one time they were toe to toe, Russell did perform better.
Yeah.
Wasn't his fault that they botched all the pit stop. And also I think there, I hadn't considered it before, but Rob's point a couple of weeks back about the possible damage that having Russell in that Williams for in another season, like there's still like almost 20 races left this season. Do you really want to put him through a third season of being in that Williams? Like, at that stage, it's been 4 years since he was racing at the front. Like, that's in a young driver, that's, you know, not ideal.
Yeah, I mean, the 2022 regulations are going to be really different. Williams does have, will have had a year under their new owners with a lot more money. So life at Williams could be different.
True.
I don't know if Mercedes would want to kill the golden goose that is Hamilton and Bottas, because that, whatever the dynamic is there, it's working. However, there are a lot, like we had a lot of driver changes for this year. We could have a lot more for next year too. There are a lot of contracts that are confirmed to be up at the end of this year. Ocon, Hamilton, Perez, and a lot that we guess are at ending at the end of this year, like both Alphas. I guess all four Alphas, Romeo's and Tauri's. Vettel's contract might be a 1 year. Schumacher's might be a 1 year. Bottas's might end this year. And Latifi's. So anything can happen.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see Williams maybe jump for another driver as well to fill either seat or both with a new car. It could be a real sea change season for them.
I think if you're Mercedes, it's got to be a little nerve-wracking too, because, okay, so say Hamilton stays for one more year, and but at some point, like, he wants out, and meanwhile, Russell moves on to a different team, and, like,
Schumacher moves on to a different team.
Yeah, the word on Russell is still, like, people think he's going to be one of the best drivers of his generation. I think there's, to a degree, an incentive to try to lock that guy down for the next era. And so, as good as Hamilton is, you don't look at him and say, well, he's going to be here for, like, you know, 5 to 10 more years. That's probably not in the cards. So yeah, I think it's kind of go or no go time for Mercedes and Russell.
I think if you're Willie, or if you're Russell, if you're not able to go to Mercedes, where do you go? Alfa Romeo? No. Alfa Tauri? Probably not. Aston Martin? Maybe, but they don't seem so hot. Certainly not Haas. Ferrari's locked up. McLaren's locked up. Not Red Bull. That's not going to happen. So why not roll the dice with the team you know?
I think there's another interesting, just to sort of like vibe off of what Rob was saying in terms of Russell, you know, maybe having a bit of trouble in that Williams, or the effect that it might have on him. If you compare him to like Lando, who is like night and day a different driver to what he was 2 years ago. And that's not because he was languishing at the back. That's because he's been with teammates who are now driving a Ferrari you know, his current teammate is a multiple race winner. He's in a car which has gone from lower in the pack to like pretty close to the top. And he's also 2 years younger than Russell. So like at a certain stage, you look at the trajectory of the two of them, right? Where Lando maybe came in as a bit more of an unknown. Russell came in, has always sort of had this association, be it through the Toto stuff or, and also obviously his on-track performances prior to F1, but you know, that he is this up-and-comer. But they're also like on two different sort of trajectories. So like once that decision comes down as well, especially if Lando keeps performing well this year, he didn't have a great race this weekend, but I think it again is an uncomfortable, you know, comparison you can make, especially if you do the whole, you know, because they're both young British drivers as well. And they're, so I think Russell probably wants to get in that mark sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Well, speaking of filling seats, in Mercedes's, Danny.
Yeah, your sort of last news, good feel good story of the week this week is with a famous IndyCar driver Romain Grosjean. Although he doesn't like ovals yet, he is getting his drive, his final F1 drive, the one that was sort of Toto after the crash last year, live on television, I think I remember him saying it, that like if there was a way that they could help him out by giving him a drive, then they'd be happy to do so. And we were kind of thinking, would that happen in Abu Dhabi maybe or something like that? It didn't. He didn't get back in a car last year. His hands were pretty badly damaged. But this March, he visited the Mercedes factory, Romain Grosjean did, in Brackley, and got fitted for their championship winning car last year, which he is going to get to drive around everyone's favorite F1 track, Circuit Paul Ricard, which actually is his local / home track, even though he's Swiss. I guess he lives down there and closer to there than Monaco, maybe. But it's his home track. And I got a quote here from him. He says, "I'm so excited to jump back in an F1 car. It will be a special opportunity for me to drive a world championship winning Mercedes. It will be a unique experience. I'm very grateful to Mercedes, F1, and to Toto for the opportunity. The first I heard about the chance to drive a Mercedes was in my hospital bed in Bahrain when Toto was speaking to the media and made the invitation. Reading that news cheered me up a lot. F1 didn't get the chance to race in France during 2020 because of COVID, so driving a Mercedes at the French Grand Prix in 2021 and then completing a test at the Circuit Paul Ricard, my home track, will be so special. I can't wait for the day to arrive." Happy days for Romain Grosjean.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah.
Watch the socials, I guess, for video from that.
Exactly.
A couple other good videos from the feed this week were...
Feed me.
Robert Wickens getting back behind the wheel of a race car. He is the Canadian IndyCar driver that was in an accident that caused him paralysis below the chest, I think, or below the hips. He got in a Brian Herta Autosport Hyundai Veloster TCR.
Ooh.
Which runs in the IMSA Michelin Pilot Series, and it's cool. He's got a first person camera that I'll post in the show notes, and it's a wheel with hand control. So you've got the steering wheel, and then on top of it is another like circular plate that you push in for throttle, and then behind the steering wheel is another ring that you pull toward you for brake.
Wow,
it's pretty cool. He chalks up the biggest hurdle, though, to getting back into a racing series is going to be finances.
Interesting.
Because, huh. I mean, yeah. he's a pro. He can drive cars no matter what the controls are. So
there were some interesting chats with Juan Manuel Correa as well, who obviously competed in F3 this past weekend, with regards to his rehab on his foot. Because I think his ankle is pretty much fused on one of his feet. But he has movement in both legs, but yeah, he said the biggest struggle so far is basically having strength in the legs for braking and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. He performed, you know, in the races, and it, you know, I can't remember exactly how he did, but he, you know, wasn't involved in any incidents and was racy, so great to see.
Cool. And then the last cool video, Carlos Sainz showed off his Ferrari steering wheel and how it all works and what the buttons do and the wheels and stuff. This is probably one of the best. I've seen a number of these. This is probably the best one that I've seen because oftentimes they just kind of gloss over stuff. Carlos does kind of a deep dive here. So, Rob, you said you enjoyed this too.
Yeah, I did. This wasn't just a, like, gee, look at all these buttons. It was a pretty decent tour of, like, what you were interacting with and changing on a lap-by-lap basis. Also, awesome. Really did make me realize these cars are hard to drive. Yeah. Like, it is constant. So that also made me realize, like, this is a part, like, we know those wheels are complicated. I think we still kind of allied in our understanding just how much, like, pilots these guys are.
Jet pilots.
Well, that's the news. In fantasy standings, you can join our fantasy league, by the way, by clicking in the link in the show notes and or using the league invite code. In the Spain round, the top three, we actually have a tie for second and third between, from Portugal, Mock Gogo, and from Canada, the Meme Team. And then top step of the Spanish podium from Mexico, Status Quo F1. Commentary on the podium, perhaps. Overall, though, over four races, in third place from Canada, Paul McCartney's Red Bull Gives You Wings.
Hmm.
Very good. From America, in second place, Danny Rick's Smile. And
it's a big one.
A familiar name at the top from Sweden, Scuderia Speedy People.
Beautiful.
I'm not doing so hot. My best team is in 490th.
Hamverbot, man. Just Hamverbot your way around the whole thing. Just
you can't add all of them. They won't let you.
Hamverbot. Use cheats. Buy more card packs. Is that how it works?
Yes. Yes, it is. Let's take it to emails, Danny.
Sure. shiftf1podcast@gmail.com or f1.cool/email. Rob, you want to read this first one from Nick?
Sure. Nick writes, hey, guys. Today, I want to talk about some of Zach Brown's deals with drivers for the year. As of now, throughout all of the teams he is involved with in all types of motorsports, there are two major ones. The first is with Daniel Ricciardo. Daniel is a huge fan of Dale Earnhardt, having grown up watching him race from Australia. It's part of the reason he chose the number three in F1. Zach Brown's massive car collection, managed by his race team United Autosports, includes a 1984 Dale Senior Chevy. Daniel has been offered the chance to drive it if he can clinch that podium. This deal is a good one, and it's the better known of the two deals he has made so far this year. Zach's other deal is with Arrow McLaren SP driver Pato O'Ward. Pato is one of the rising stars of IndyCar, and he was promised a drive for McLaren Formula One at the Abu Dhabi Young Drivers Test if he won a race for McLaren in IndyCar. Well, at the Texas doubleheader last week, Pato managed to charge to the front and win race two, thus guaranteeing him the postseason test. These deals of Zach's have raised so many questions to me. Should other teams start offering non-conventional motivations to their drivers? Could Zach's dealings in both Indy and F1 bring an Indy star to F1 like the days of old? The last three Indy drivers who came to F1 are Sebastian Bourdais, Juan Pablo Montoya, and Jacques Villeneuve. Will Zach ever stop being a likable man? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thanks for the great show every week. So, my take on this is these are cute deals, and they're basically meaningless. Like, driver motivation is not something you really need to solve with, like, fun little treats. Like, these guys get all kinds of opportunities to drive cool shit. This isn't like Roman, like, and his valedictory tour of racing, like, getting a right. shot in a Mercedes. Like, I think with Ricardo loves making laddish bar bets about stuff. It's a way to, like, it showcases personality. It humanizes both driver and team owner and makes it seem, like, less transactional in some ways. With Pato, I think the this is kind of what Mario was alluding to a couple weeks ago. There are other reasons there's a problem developing a pipeline between IndyCar and F1. I think one of the big ones is I'm not sure that super license points accrue for performance in IndyCar. And
they do.
They do?
Yeah.
Then, yeah, but, like, there is a the thing that Mario sort of flagged is just they're not looking for talent in IndyCar, and there doesn't seem to be a connection between the two.
They're not looking for talent that isn't very young these days.
Yeah.
So, like, if you're good at IndyCar, you're not 19.
Pato's a young guy.
I mean, Patricio Ward is a young guy, but he's not going to leave Indy now.
Well, and also all the teams want their driver development programs. They also they're obliged to funnel their own pipelines into the sport.
And they're deep.
They are deep, yeah. Look, I mean, look at F3. Look how many drivers are on the grid and how many of them are team drivers with one of them, like with Alpine, with Ferrari, with Red Bull.
That being said,
I can kind of give a...
You're going.
A quick overview of that. Mercedes has 4 young drivers right now. Alfa Romeo has 8. Alpine has 5.
8.
Ferrari's got 7. McLaren has 1. Who is an American, actually? And Red Bull AlphaTauri has 8.
Who's the McLaren?
His name is Ugo Chukwu. He's in karting, so they're getting him young.
Oh, right. Okay. God, isn't it? Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, cool to see Pato Award in an F1 car, but
that would be cool.
It doesn't happen all that often, right?
I mean, I think
only 20 seats.
Long term, Zach is a smart business guy. That's clear. Yeah. I do think he will recognize. I think Zach Brown, the people in IndyCar recognize they have an interest in this. F1 realizes they have an interest in creating some sort of crossover from American racing into F1. And so I do think, like, at some point they probably need to see this for the growth of the sport. I don't know if Pato would be the guy they'd go with. He's real good. But I think they would. Like one of the reasons Mario was pushing Colton Herta out was like put that big all American flag on the driver's car. You know, Pato as a Irish American Mexican who is a citizen of Mexico. I think he's great. He's a compelling driver. But I think we might see someone else get the nod first. I do think if anyone could create some crossover between the worlds of racing, Zach Brown, who has sort of put McLaren in all these spaces, might be someone to try and arrange it.
I love Pato Award as a Irish. I think I've mentioned it before, but the only other Irish Mexican collaboration I know was a Mexican Irish fusion restaurant in my hometown, which only lasted for about 6 months with the title Paddy Gonzalez, which I thought was pretty good.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
so good.
Yeah.
Should I take this one from Sam?
Yeah, do it.
Sam says, "Hey, Speedy Boys, I've spent the past week touring the Finger Lakes in upstate New York, mostly pretending to get hints of stone fruit during wine tastings.
Wow.
However, we have some time to kill in the town of Watkins Glen. It rang a bell, but I didn't put it together until I saw the checkered flag pedestrian crossings. We drove up to the circuit and spoke to the attendant at the gate and asked if we could watch the drivers on circuit as we could hear a few cars going around the track. He said that unfortunately we couldn't due to COVID restrictions, but then he asked us if we wanted to put our rental hybrid Toyota Corolla on the track. We hung out for a while before a pace car led us and 5 other cars around the track for 3 laps. The things that stood out were the elevation changes and how narrow parts of the circuit were. It seems impossible that cars could overtake each other there. We weren't really going that fast, although listening to the F1 theme and the Teriyaki Boys made it feel more intense, only around 70 miles per hour tops. But the feeling going through the chicane made me feel like the car was about to roll and I was bricking it the entire time. I definitely left with an even greater respect for what race drivers do. Has anyone on the pod driven at a circuit? If not, what circuit would you like to take a spin at? Thanks, Sam."
That's so cool.
Wow.
I love the idea that he just like wandered up and you're like, "Hey, I want to go. You want to go on Watkins Glen?
Like, want to
go
one of those famous?" I think I'm like,
"Yeah, you should do it, man." Rob is like rubbing his beard that whole time, like, "Wait, this is a thing I can do." That sounds cool.
How much to remove the pace car? Like, well, how much do I have to pay to be like, "Okay, I'll sign what I need to sign"? Like, if I like bin this thing, it's on me.
Nordschleife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only circuit I've ever driven at was I did like a drive in for my brother's birthday. We both got a drive in, like an old stock car around it was like a quarter mile oval, like very small, which was really cool. I had to relearn how to drive a stick again. Like it's something that I know, but like is not ingrained in me to the point where I felt comfortable hopping in a race car. Mm. So I think I've told the story before, but we tried to find a rental manual and there was one in the Bay Area.
You're kidding.
When we were scheduled to go do it, it was at a shop because someone had burned out the clutch.
You're kidding me.
Yes.
I'm surprised they don't have more of them because like I'd never driven an automatic until I moved here. So like if I was a tourist coming to America, I wouldn't want an automatic. I guess now automatics are more common.
It's easier to go the other way.
It is easier to go the other way, but also it's weird. Like the first time I drove an automatic, I was like, what is going on here? Like, is this going to, if I stop on a hill, will I be able to start without it rolling backwards? That type of thing. Because like I'm so used to having the clutch and knowing where my buoy point is on
the hill.
That's
the one part I could never, like the thought of driving a manual in the Bay Area or even out here because we got some decent hills in Massachusetts. I'm like, that's the part where I'm like, I couldn't handle that. The stress
of rolling.
There was
one hill in my hometown called Bunker's Hill because there's a bunker on the top. And it was like, I don't know. It felt like it was like, you know,
45 degrees.
Yeah, but it probably wasn't. But that was where everyone did their tests. To see, and it's funny, it's one of those roads that has like a stoplight at the top and then there's a gap on the thing that says like keep clear because the amount of people that roll back like 5 feet when they're trying to go up, because everyone drives manuals, at least they did when I was growing up. Now there's more automatics.
I gotta run. The short answer is no, I've never driven a car on a circuit, but now that seems a lot more achievable, so TBD.
Totally.
Take care, off to get shot number two.
Yes, all right. congrats good luck, and good luck, Rob.
I would love to drive Laguna Seca.
Yeah, like just to do the corkscrew and to see what it's like.
I would love to do that.
I bet it's like the same as anything. Like when we went to Circuit of the Americas, really seeing how high turn one is.
it's
ridiculous. It's like, what was it? It's like 120 floors up. You could fit a building between the start finish straight in the top or something. It's insane.
I don't think it's 120
floors.
Is it
not? I thought it was like, maybe
I think it's 100, maybe 120 feet.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe that makes sense. Whatever. Somebody shift F1 podcast at Gmail.
There you go. Let us know. We also got a few people writing in over Twitter, showing us pictures of Daniel Ricciardo with a mouth guard.
Oh,
who
interesting.
Appears to be the only driver who uses one, which I still don't really understand. Don't you want to like, I don't know. You might get in an accident.
He does have a particularly large. I'm not taking a piss. He does actually have like a particularly large mouth, and like his teeth are very prevalent. So I wonder if it's a particular problem for him, maybe, because we're talking about millimeters and centimeters and inches here, right? When it comes to helmets and all that sort of stuff,
he's got him insured.
His teeth. Oh, that's a good point.
There's trademark, baby.
I know. Yeah, he's got. Yeah, that smile. That smile. The smile came up in the. Already today on the podcast, so
it's true.
We love it.
If you would like to hit us up on Twitter, you can do so at Shift F1 Podcast. I am at Drew Scanlon. That is at Danny O'Dwyer. Rob is at Rob Zachney. That's us around the internet. Should we take it around the world, Danny?
Let's race around the world. Yeah.
Speaking of American racetracks, U.S. Formula 4 is back this weekend at Road America for the Spring Vintage Festival. We also have IndyCar at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway road course for the GMR Grand Prix.
I love GNR. It's great.
GMFNR. NASCAR Xfinity Series is at the Dover International Speedway for the Dover 200. MotoGP is in France for the Shark Grand Prix de France.
Jumping the shark. Where is that? Yes. What circuit is the French MotoGP?
Circuit Bugatti in Le Mans. Okay.
There you go.
The IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship is in Lexington, Ohio at the Mid-Ohio Sports Car Course for the Acura Sports Car Challenge.
Everyone's driving an Acura.
Yep, that's the rule.
Them's the
Super
rules.
Super Formula is at Autopolis.
Jesus, we're back. The future. Yes. Autopolis. It's the city in Cars, right? The Pixar movie.
Yeah, it's the city in Kamitsue Village in Hita City, Oita Prefecture, Japan.
Classic prefecture.
And we got NASCAR.
Road America.
They're actually at the most American state of Delaware.
Delaware.
For
if you hate corporate taxes, which I know you do because you're American.
Oh, yeah. The Dover International Speedway for the Dradeen 400.
Wow.
My darling Dradeen.
Dradeen, I'll meet you at Rehoboth Beach.
Is that a beach there?
That's a beach in Delaware. Yes, from my Maryland days. If you wanted to go to the coast, go to Rehoboth. Head over to Rehoboth Beach. Beautiful. Sandy, sunny, lots of amusements. What do you guys call those? Carnivals? Do you call them amusements? We call them amusements.
Amusement park?
Amusement parks. Does that also include, like, if you're just on a beach and there's like a big wheel and a carousel? What would you call that?
That's more of a boardwalk.
Boardwalk, okay, yeah. Amusements.
At the Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk.
Yeah.
In the warm California sun. Boardwalk!
Is that a song?
It's the commercials. It's the commercials you would hear on the radio, on the television as a kid.
Just go to the boardwalk. California. Do you see one of those in San Francisco?
There's still Pier 39.
Oh, I meant on like the ocean beach side.
Oh.
There was like...
Did there really?
Yeah, there was like an amusement and a boardwalk and stuff. When you go to Santa Cruz, they have like a memorial for all the boardwalks that used to exist. Apparently, there was way more of them. Yeah, like it was way more of a thing on the coast, apparently. Yeah, and Santa Cruz is like, we're still here, God damn it.
Wow. Then everyone realized Ocean Beach is freezing cold.
So cold. No one went to the boardwalk. I grew up on the Atlantic coast, and it's like... I thought, like, oh, it'll probably be warm there. It's California. It's freezing.
Yeah.
All year round.
Yep. We're not freezing. Nope.
We're for Formula One and Monaco.
There we go. Thank you, Danny. If you'd like to support the show and get access to all of our bonus episodes, you can do so over at patreon.com/shiftf1. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.
Yeah.